How's your new car search going?
So, you know, I've been looking around a little bit. Most likely going to get an SUV and maybe like a smaller one. I'm doing a search and I'm looking around, and then I see all this information coming up about the RSX coming back. And I was like, the RSX coming back? When does this happen? So they're actually making an SUV RSX, which is weird, because the first thing that I thought of when I saw that was Mitsubishi doing the Eclipse, you know, like, what was that, 2012, was it? So it wasn't a complete disaster in terms of sales. It did okay for them, but for enthusiasts, we were like, you know, everyone was upset of it, you know, obviously, especially you, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, it was the only Eclipse that I've ever seen in my life that made me want to look directly at the sun until I went blind.
Right.
Yeah, there was so many different ways for them to go with that, and then there was that. Like, that's the best that they could come up with.
I guess the idea, I mean, I think everybody thinks the same thing. When they're bringing these names back, these iconic names, the idea is to try to hook people that were interested in that vehicle 10, 20, whatever years ago, right? Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's a familiar name. It's something people you know, are familiar with. You bring it back in a different form, and then hopefully they'll cling to it, you know. And I think we saw that with the Integra, right? There was really no reason for them to do the Integra. They had a couple of entry-level vehicles along the way, and they're like, hey, let's take the Civic, change it just a little bit, put the Integra nameplate on it. We got an Integra. And it was kind of like, you know, it was kind of a disaster when it first hit.
I get that. I think it's more about the fact that I think it's so difficult to put a new name or a new brand or a new product line out for these and get the amount of money I think it takes them to be able to market and get this out to everybody, I think just takes a tremendous amount of effort. Whereas sure. I think it tremendously cuts down that effort when you immediately go to something that they've heard before for many years, right? I don't think that they think they're going to get the enthusiasts back as much as I think it's going to be easier for them to be able to market to the masses and make them feel like, oh, you know this vehicle. Like, you've seen this before. You know it's a good name. It's done things. You know what I mean?
But it is a weird thing, though, to hear the name RSX and go, oh, yeah, I remember those. And then you see, you know, an SUV. It's completely, you know, completely different.
Well, it was like the same thing we scoffed at when they did it with the Ford, when they did that Mach-E thing with, you know, right. The Mustang Mach-E. It's like, right. There's nothing Mustang about this, you know?
Yeah. It's funny, one of my neighbors has a Mach-E and he loves it. Like, he's not a car guy, but he would have never, just having known him for the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, he would have never would have even thought about a Mustang. I think he had a Mini before, right? So for him, what attracted him to the Mach-E was like the style of it, and he wanted an EV, and it just kind of like the two things came. They had a good deal, and it just worked out for him. He loves it. He's had it now for 2 years, and he loves it.
I can't figure out the weird fascination that we have as Americans about getting really big SUVs and wanting mm-hmm. them to be sports cars. Like, and here's the thing. Because, like, you basically took the heaviest, most unaerodynamic thing that would have the, you know, not a chance of having a good center of gravity, and you basically said, let's make it fast and handle better. And I think it's such an oxymoron. But just so that everybody understands that I'm the total hypocrite, I actually have a Q7 that I want to do the same exact thing to. So I understand this is the cake and eat it too issue, right?
Right.
Because you want to be able to, just like you're going through, you want to be able to have something that you drive every day that still has a little punch, it still feels sporty, but also you got to haul around all those kids that you made, and it's like, right. Well, what do we do with this, right? So, like, right. That's why I have it, but it is kind of incredible when you think that we, like, expect to have the same type of thing out of an SUV. Like, how stupid are we?
But what's interesting, too, is, like, going back to the Ford, the Mach-E thing,
yeah.
You would think, okay, they came up with this EV thing. Maybe some people will get into it. Maybe some people won't. It doubled sales as compared to the regular gas-powered Mustang. So in the last quarter of last
year. Is that right?
Yes, double.
Wow.
Which is insane, right? You would think, I don't really see that many on the road, but I see even less Mustangs, you know, like 2024, 2025 models.
Yeah. But is it because before, when you went to go buy a Mustang, you were getting a rear-wheel drive performance sports car, and now you may be getting the name, but are they like, does the name even factor into it? You know, do they care? Is it just, if they would have put something else on it, would it have just been, you know, an EV that works for them? And now they're selling into a whole different category. You know what I mean?
I think the idea was have Mustang be its own thing.
Yeah.
So Mustang, the performance vehicle that everyone knows and it's been around forever, yep, as well as the SUV Mach-E thing. And there's probably going to be something else in that realm as well. And it's all going to be in that its own little pool, kind of separate off to the side.
It's like the Mustang brand. And then here's the line within the brand.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. It worked.
It's interesting.
I mean, it worked. In this case, it worked, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know that you can say the same for every model, but for that, going back to the Integra, it didn't really get the best reception when it first, you know, when it hit dealership showrooms.
Yeah.
But then, well, I think when the Type S came out, people got excited, but then it priced itself like way out of the market. Yeah, I never see them around.
Yeah, me either. I saw one on the road the other day, and I actually looked at it, and I said, you know, it looks cool, but then I thought about how much money it took, and I'm like, yeah, I don't think. Like, have you ever been in one of those Type S's?
I've not, never. The regular Integra, not the Type S.
So I was in one of the Type S's, and you know what bothered me the most is I said the interior in here feels cheap.
Yeah, like so, a Civic.
Yeah, but here's the thing: I think they did a better job with the Civic Type R interior than they did with the Type S,
because the
Type R has very purposeful, you know, and there are some things with Type S. I get that, but it feels like it's engraved. It's stitched well. It like looks everything. It like looks the part, and you kind of feel like this is along the brand line. And then you see the other stuff, and you're like, oh, they just wanted to put some leather covers over it. Like they stuck some red some places, and it's not like the same thought out measure. It feels like as the Type R is, but it's hard. I think so. When they bring back some of these cars and some of these brands, and you have a thing, we saw it with the Supra. Right? Like we saw it two ways with the Supra. Because first they had the concept car.
Right.
And then
everyone went crazy about, right? It blew up.
Absolutely.
And everyone was like, you know, rubbing their hands together, waiting for that to come out. And then when it finally came out, it didn't look the same.
You would have seen that car in person, right? Because that was out your way, right?
Yep.
How is that as a concept?
I mean, it's incredible, but you know, the concepts are always so over the top compared to what the actual model will be. They're usually lower, and there's carbon everywhere, all that kind of stuff. I think it's just when the Supra actually dropped, the main thing behind that was the fact that they collaborated with BMW. The whole running joke, of nice BMW bro, that became like a thing and such a stigma. And I didn't think they're going to outgrow that. It seems like they kind of have, though. People nowadays are like, whatever, who cares?
Right.
And it did its thing. It's outselling the Nissan Z. By quite a bit. There's probably a lot more of them being made, but you know, it seems like it's made its mark. It's sticking around.
I know. The one thing I like about Toyota is that they do seem to listen, right? Like when they heard people saying for you, like, oh, no manual, they came out with a manual. You know what I mean? Like, you know, now whether it was them listening or the fact the Z pushed them into that category of if you want to sell some, you're going to need one of these things.
Yep.
But you know, I think that's a good, you know, it's a good example. Like they brought that thing back. I think the first tremor was the fact that the car didn't really capture what everybody thought it was going to capture when it was, what did they call it? FT1, right?
Yeah.
And then when they brought it as the, you know, and they said, oh, that's going to be rumored the Supra, you know? Right. And then everybody's like, oh, that's really dope. And then all of a sudden, when the Supra came out, it was like, oh, wait, it's a BMW. But I will say in the Supra defense, that was the one that I actually think it's really hard for people to argue that Supra wasn't at least encompassing what the, you know, what the previous generation Supra did. Because you look on paper, I mean, look, The 2JZ was a very, very stout engine, and it was also a very tunable platform. And I believe that same thing holds true with the A90 Supra. I think if you look on specs, and yes, I understand the car can be tuned to whatever, but if you look at specs, I think the new Supra clearly outdoes what the mark Mark IV, which I hate calling because it's really not, whatever, but like what that Supra did, right? The A80 and the A90, I mean, clearly the A90 is an improvement all the way around.
Right.
But you're right. It's got a shared platform. That B58, you know, that, you know, it's got the pieces. It's turbo. It's they did the right thing. It's just not what people were expecting because it was so BMW like.
Right. Ish. Right. I mean, it is, was BMW. Right?
Yeah.
Everything under the sheet metal is, and then that, and then that's kind of coming on the heels of like the 86 BRZ thing, and everyone kind of like getting that at Toyota. Why can't they make their own vehicles? Like, why are they sharing all these platforms with everyone? But then they did the GR Yaris and Corolla, GR Corolla, and that's theirs, right? That's their own, their own product. You know what I mean? So it proves they can do that. And now I see a bunch of rumors or a bunch of stuff online now that, you know, they're going to do the Celica. They're going to bring that back.
I heard the MR2 so, as well, right?
Both. Yeah, both. So that's the, I guess they went from rumor to they're starting to trademark stuff. So it's going to probably happen.
Yeah.
So and they're aiming at 2026.
I'm just so worried about, do they come back? Like, look, did you like the Prelude that they reintroduced, Honda? See, I didn't either. Like, it looked very, very dainty. It almost made me feel like it was just a larger, what do they used to call those? The Beats?
Yeah.
You know?
The one interesting thing about it is it's a coupe. There hasn't been a coupe since like, what, 9th-gen Civic, I think, was like the last one. Maybe the Accord around that time too. So the fact they're doing a coupe is very, very interesting. But the fact that, you know, it's going to be a hybrid is kind of like, I know it turns a lot of people off. You know, that's a major factor. I think they're taking the engine out of the Civic hybrid and they're just putting it in there.
Wait, what?
So the engine that's in the Civic hybrid, I think they're going to use that same setup for the Prelude. It'll probably have maybe like a little bit more power, but
that's not the 1.5.
I think it's a 2 liter.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know. Hybrid system.
Yeah. I don't know. The full on hybrid systems are hard for me sometimes. I mean, some of the mild hybrid systems aren't so bad, but they're really just more about like, you know, maintaining energy rather than sucking it away. But I don't know. I mean, like, I think there are so many cars that when they come back to market, I don't know why they lose so much of what the car was all about. And I think, you know, definitely on an enthusiast level, you expect when you get into a Supra or when you buy a Supra for it to have certain things. And I know for me, when I got in it, you know, just seeing the shifter on a Supra on the A90 and listening to the chime and seeing the hazard button and all those little things that are very, if you've been in a BMW, they're like staples to the interior and how the car feels.
Yeah.
That was offsetting to me. Like I was just like, oh crap. Like this is a BMW. Like it just, it wasn't even like, I think they could have left everything in line. I think if they had just done a little bit more on the interior to make it a little Toyota-ish, although arguably some people have pointed out, which I think is correctly, that if they had done that and made it more Toyota-ish on the inside, that it would have felt cheesier and plasticier.
It's possible. So if you look at the interior and something like the GR Corolla, it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad, you know.
And it's, those cars are expensive for what they are.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing too. You mentioned the MR2.
Yeah.
They're like kind of, you know, just estimating stuff right now. Nobody knows, but they're talking about like 65 grand and it's going to be a limited number of them made. 65K is a lot.
I know, but the problem is, and this is the problem with all cars right now that are new, is that 65,000 is what a $40,000 car was 6 years ago.
True.
That's the underlying problem. And the problem is that people like us that have been driving for more than 5 years, we remember what we feel a $30,000 and $40,000 car should be. And when you go to the dealership and now that, you know, what would have been a $400 a month payment turns into, you know, an almost $700 a month payment.
Yeah. You're
like, wait, this is not, I could get a BMW, but the truth is you can't get a BMW. Like you can't get one of these other cars because they're not $700 anymore. They're $1,200.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's hard to take. You look at these, and I think what makes it even worse on all these levels is when you get some of these cars in, this premium thing that dealers do, I wish the manufacturers would say to them, hey, listen, your premiums kill your car sales. Stop trying to make a crazy margin above and beyond MSRP. Like, MSRP is there for a reason. Like, nobody right. wants to spend above and beyond MSRP. I understand some cars have limited production and it's like, well, we only have so many to go around. I get it. But then that premium ends up running dry. It runs out. But
of course.
The fact that they've figured out, like, on some of these cars, just because it's a GR Corolla, who cares? Like, I hate to say it like that, but, like, you know, it's a 1.3 liter turbo that, yes, is quick, and yes, it's all-wheel drive based, sort of. But when it comes down to it, like, it's still a small Corolla. Like, you gotta want to have that car. You gotta want to have those features. You gotta be that enthusiast. So, like, you're making it to the point where they're just like, nah, I'm not going to spend, you know, $65,000 to get this car when the MSRP is, you know, 40.
Well, you figure if the MR2 is going to be 65 grand, they're going to mark it up, right? So you're talking about, you know, MR2 for, like, you know, 75, 80 grand. This is just, you know, hypothetically speaking, of course, but I can't imagine people, you know, jump. Already it's bad enough with, like, the Civic Type R.
Yeah.
You know, they went crazy with that car. I think the Supra, when it first came out, they did, but then it, you know, that fizzled over time.
Yeah. No, the same thing. I was hearing that with Z's too, and that lived very, that was like this long. You know what I mean?
Right.
But, you know, that's because, you know, have you driven the new Z?
Never. No, I've been in the GT car, just kind of messed around with it, but I didn't actually drive it, of course. But
I've been in one.
I imagine it feels a lot like the old one.
It doesn't.
In terms of, just,
it doesn't. I don't think it does. Well, at least from my opinion, I've only been in the passenger seat of one, right? So I can't really say how it feels driving wise, but, like, I think they did bring back a little bit of the nostalgia thing that they were trying to capture by going, like, in the 240Z interior. You feel a little bit lower, a little bit more space in certain areas than maybe you did in the previous Zs. But the car inherently doesn't feel as good as it should. It doesn't feel as tight as it should. It doesn't feel, and you know, I mean, on paper, that engine combination really should have made it, that, you know what I mean? Like, that was a pretty potent. They're doing some cool things with that car in the queue. These cars are so new. I haven't heard anybody take on any preconception of what they hope the car will be yet. Like, I haven't really, but it's true. It's like, and when I think an MR2, like, is, you know, are they still projecting that's going to be like a mid-engine car?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's cool.
So at the Auto Salon, they had a car, I think it was a Yaris, that had a mid-engine setup, and everyone thought it was just like a one-off thing. But then a lot of speculation came about that that's probably the testing they're doing for the MR2.
Right.
Because that chassis is compatible, right? You can kind of change things up a little bit and then see how it performs.
Right.
So that could be like the start of that.
Yeah. I think it comes down to, does the brand resonate, right? Because at the end of the day, like, we bitch about a lot of different things, but, like, the same way all the Corvette guys were bitching about when they got the rear engine, mid-engine Corvette.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, nobody wanted to have anything to do with it. It wasn't a Corvette. Next thing you know, they sold a bunch of them. So
yeah, they're everywhere now. Yeah.
They're great cars.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, I don't know that it's, like, my favorite cup of tea, but, like, it on paper, what a bargain they are. Really. And especially if you get ones that are a year old, there's no mileage on those cars. And, like, $65,000. Now, again, obviously, I can't tell you, you know, the whole manual thing is still a little bit of play on it, but you know, the more I start looking at those, like, those ZF8 HP swaps and stuff that people are doing, the more I kind of think, maybe I'm just old and bitter and then just getting stuck in my own ways. Because I got to be honest with you, that transmission on is fantastic and they're doing some really amazing swaps with it.
They hold a ton of power, right?
Yeah, a ton of power. Yeah. Very, very inexpensive. It's like got the case swap series recipe from the transmission aspect. And then there's that one company that's building a TCU for it. So, like, it takes very few input wires to be able to get this thing to kind of read up to in, up to the to a factory ECU to be able to piggyback in and kind of figure out the logic to make the you know, the dual clutch to work. And it's a it's a pretty robust unit, takes a lot of power, can be swapped into a lot of different things. Its size isn't crazy long, so you have good positioning that you can work with there. And it's just used on a lot of different cars and trucks. So you know, it's interesting. It's like, you know, again, I always struggle. Like, I like the idea of rowing through the gears, and that really does something for me. But you know, I wonder if that's just going to really subside. I mean, how many of these younger kids don't even know how to drive a manual car anyway?
The majority. With this sort of like bringing back the iconic names like, you know, Integra, Z, Super, all that stuff, we kind of have this last wave, it feels like, of combustion engine sports cars or sporty cars. Do you think this is it? Like, this is like going to be the last final stand before everything either goes hybrid or EV? I think hybrid first and EV.
I'll be honest with you. I think the EV thing got pushed back, and I don't think we're going to really see EV become a heavy populated option for maybe another 10 years or so. I think we're about to see a strong wave, which is the wave that it should have always been, to be honest with you, if you want to go from a emission side, of hybrid vehicles. Now, when we say hybrid, I think the problem that we've suffered is no one's really defined hybrid. And what I mean by that is when you say hybrid, that's basically like saying car, because it's such a big term, right? It's got all these different things that potentially it could be. Mild hybrids basically don't have anything except basically a different type of alternator that use a belt that's essentially recharging, you know, like a 48 like one of those like 48, I don't want to say amp batteries, but you know what I'm talking about. Like one of the bigger 48 volt batteries, sorry. And then they have, you know, other hybrid systems, which are a little bit more integrated, like with using regenerative braking to be able to charge these batteries. And all these batteries really do is power other systems to whatever. Right. And then there's the hybrids that actually have, you know, give you a power boost and kind of like, you know, like I think about the Corvette E-Ray and some of the other things. And then you have the full-on plug-in hybrids that will operate on a, you know, an electric, you know, motor for, let's say, 20 or 40 miles and then on a single charge. And then you use the gasoline engine. So there's hybrids like across the board in very different variations. And not everyone feels so detrimental. You know. I don't know.
I think I was a little bit more against it before we got a family car. We got a Kia, right? And it's like a van, and it's got the hybrid assist, right? And so it's a little tiny 1.6 turbo engine to pull this big van around. And with that extra kick from that thing, I mean, it's like it feels like a V6,
right?
You know, and we're still getting like 40 or averaging like 40 mpg, which is crazy to have you know, four of us in there in a big van, you know, cruising down the highway.
It
makes sense for sure.
It makes sense. And the truth is, I think that there's a lot of things that could be done to make cars more exciting. Now, I will tell you the scary thing for me as somebody that works on a lot of his own cars is that we're slowly getting to that point that you're not really going to be able to. And what I'm also concerned with is like you get done with your lease, you know, is the idea of being able to buy a car out over. You know what I mean? Or finance a car, because, you know, you figure you get to 5 years and now even these hybrid systems that are going to have just very simple type of hybrid, mild hybrid situations, are you going to get to a point where it's like, oh, well, you know, the reason you're throwing that check engine light is because the hybrid battery went bad. And you're like, all right, well, you know, how much is a battery? And they're like, oh, it's only like $4,800. And you're like, well, wait a minute, hold on. Like, is
the car's worth six.
That's my fear. Which brings in another thing of like, you know, how do aftermarket companies actually resurface you know, in this scene? But I think potentially, like you said, there could be a lot of good things that, you know, a hybrid assist could do. I just, when you bring stuff back, you want the idea that people can tune them, I think, is everything. I really do. I think if you create a hybrid and people have battery control units, and if you allow the aftermarket to still exist, where people can get excited about making their car something more, something better, something different, improve on its handling, improve on all these items that make your driving experience better, I think you'll still continue to carry the recipe forward. If you get to a point where you make something where it can't be touched, and I think that's why the Tesla stuff is really difficult, because it's like, for me, I like the idea of the Tesla and playing with the tech, but then like I can't do anything really to it.
Well, it's a good point we were making, because with newer vehicles like Supra, for example, if you couldn't modify that for whatever reason, let's say the ECU was impossible to get into, or the engine, you know, didn't take good to mods, it might have killed that enthusiast market for it. I mean, it's huge. You can do a lot with that car, right? You can do a lot with that engine. You can make a lot of power. That's been proven. Moving forward, I don't know if you can do that with the Prelude, right? If the Prelude comes out and it's got like this hybrid system, probably not, right? Hmm. With the Celica and MR2, it sounds like they're going to be 100% gas-powered, manual, possibly all-wheel drive. So, I mean, those you could probably, as long as you can get into them,
yeah,
they're going to still carry a big following, I would think. You know,
I would think so. It's kind of like preserving what people want still. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you get the support from the enthusiast crowd, which, you know, is pretty vocal and social, obviously. We know that.
Yeah, right.
Right. So that stuff, hopefully, I would think, pushes sales a little bit.
Right.
Even if you're not like a hardcore enthusiast, you're like, man, everybody's talking about this car. It's so great. Let me go check it out. They go in, they drive it, they like it, they buy it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I hope so. I hope that they don't get too proud with their MSRPs and stuff like that. I hope they don't get too proud with their premiums, because I think this is what, you know, this is what we need. We need, I mean, listen, we have gotten to a point where when we say, you know, I know for a while during certain periods of the past, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, the term EV has taken on one thing, and almost internal combustion engine has become almost like a dirty word. Like it's not. Yeah. But when I tell you how efficient some of these direct injected combustion engines are nowadays, it's really incredible. And so, you know, I think it's really important that they just stay true to what the cars are and not get too far away from, or what the cars were always were, and not get too far away from that. Because I think by getting farther away from that is where you start to detach the enthusiast. And then who cares if it says MR2 on it? Like, no one cares, right?
Yeah. I sound like a hater with the Prelude thing, and I understand that. I get that. But just from what I've seen on paper, it doesn't look like it's anything close to what the original Prelude generations were. And you look at that Prelude, like that following that group, not nearly as popular as like the Civic and CRX crowd of like, you know, the late 80s and 90s and all that.
Right.
But the Prelude fan base is fiercely loyal. Like they all stick together. So I don't imagine they're going to be jumping all over this thing when it comes out just because it has a name on it, you know?
You know, the last thing I'll say before we kind of wrap up is like, when, you know, I think back to 2010 when Honda asked us to basically build this new car that they had, the CRZ, right?
And I did one of those two. Same time.
Yeah. So when we got this car, I remember thinking like, oh, this is going to be the modern day CRX. The hybrid system was very intrusive. It wasn't the same as we were hope, you know, whatever it was.
Right. It was early still.
It was absolutely. Yep. It almost felt like the car could have been so much more than it was. And I think that's why I liked BC's car so much, because when he swapped it with, because they did a K swap on it, and like, right?
No, he did a turbo setup. It was Eibach and Hossport. They joined forces and they did a K24.
Okay, yeah. But when they pulled that off, I remember thinking those cars, I'm like, well, yeah, because that's what we wanted.
Oh, should have. Yeah, right.
That's what we wanted. We could have just done that, guys. If we had just done that, I think they would have sold a lot of cars.
Did you ever get the chance to drive a K-swap CRZ?
No, never.
Okay. So I drove two, a K20 and a K24, and I also drove a supercharged version.
Okay.
With the factory engine. Of the three, none of them did it for me. Just really? that car as a chassis. Just
is it just Bodhi? It's Bodhi and floaty and heavier than the exactly. CRX was.
Exactly. And everyone at that time was saying, no, it's a good chassis because it's reinforced and it's so much stronger than the Civic and all the stuff. It wasn't good in my opinion. It wasn't good. So
I can
idea of doing a case swap now on one of those, I wouldn't do it personally. I just wouldn't.
No, but I can totally see that. I you're right. I haven't driven one of those that were swapped, And I can see that because I drove the car obviously as it was, right?
Sure.
So,
sure.
So I can totally, yeah, it was. I could totally understand though, you know, how that car becomes floaty and heavy and stuff like that. I mean, the one thing about the CRX was the reason it felt like it was on rails because it was probably the closest thing you can get to a go-kart as possible at the time.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. There was a lot of rawness there, but there was also a lot of like this is the bare minimum of what you need for a car.
Like with great suspension.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, low curb weight. It was a great combination.
Yeah. It was agile, it was nimble, it was a good car. Listen, I think the question is posed out to maybe some people out there. The question is, as they bring back some of these iconic brands and some of these iconic models, are you still going to be into these cars if they don't come with maybe the internal combustion engine? Can they still win your heart over through styling and the right power numbers, even if maybe it's done through, let's say, a 1.3 liter engine and having to have a hybrid assist? Can they still be there if the power equivalent and the drivability and all the cool stuff is there? And the last question I think I want to ask people is, let me know what you think. If they make these modern day platforms, even if they have EV assist or hybrid assist, and the aftermarket does create a way, and the OEs don't block, you know, lock ECUs to the point where we get to a point where we're now able to tune hybrid systems and battery systems and make the cars better and faster and everything we want it to be, does that still rock the boat? Like, are you still in? Do you still want to buy these cars and tune them? Or is that ship sailed once it gets too, you know, techie? I don't know. So, all right. Well, that's it for this one. We'll catch you on the next one.